This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Where the Deer and the Antelope Play, the pastoral observations of one ignorant American who loves to walk outside. This is the author, Nick Offerman. To the children of the players herein, our hope and delight, plus Tom. Molly, B, Isaac, Tom, Spencer, Sammy, Caitlin, Elena, Elise, Holly, Sunshine, Maggie, Harper. Sorry for the cussing, kids, but sometimes a man gets riled. Introduction. In many ways, the inception of this book occurred 105 years ago, when I was working on a production of Sam Shepard's Buried Child at Chicago's excellent Steppenwolf Theater Company. Back then, I had been well on my way to a comfortable life of blind materialism, hopefully emulating one of David Lee Roth's insouciant musical short films I had newly come to adore on a brilliant new cable channel, simply called, get this, Music Television. Little did I suspect that by the time that play had closed, the trajectory of my life would be forever altered. Sam himself had come to town to do some rewriting and polishing on his script, even though it had won him a Pulitzer Prize back in 1979. I guess he didn't entirely agree with the Pulitzer folks. That was certainly his prerogative, and I guess that's what made him so damn handsome, I mean smart. The production was a pretty big deal, directed as it was by Steppenwolf founding member Gary Sinise, and starring some honest-to-God hotshots like Lois Smith, Ted Levine, Kelly Overby, Ethan Hawke, and the late, great James Gammon. Gary, a legendary actor and director, also happens to be an awfully generous fellow, if you're ever lucky enough to meet him. He always treated me quite equitably, even though the first time we met, I was unaware his name was pronounced Sinise, and I said, "It's nice to meet you, Mr. Sinus." Despite that initial gaffe, Gary hired me as an understudy for the show and also as a makeup artist to apply old-age makeup to James Gammon every night, just by way of some stippling and painted modeling with highlights and shadows, nothing fancy. I had a scenery shop in the warehouse where I lived, or I guess to be accurate, I should say I had a futon and a hot plate in the warehouse where I cohabitated with my table saw and my pin nailers. I had also previously made some props for Steppenwolf, including some masks for Alex and his droogs in A Clockwork Orange, a play in which I also appeared and served as fight captain. All of which is to say, I was lucky as hell to be the jack-of-all-trades gopher kid running around the theater the night Sam Shepard corralled me, slipped me $40, and told me to go get him a bottle of Maker's Mark. Now, I had gone to theater school in Urbana-Champaign in the late 80s and early 90s, which means that Sam Shepard was still the biggest rock star cowboy playwright in America. Not to mention Chuck Yeager in The Right Stuff, hard eyes emoji, when he sent me to get him a very specific handle of Kentucky Straight Bourbon, which means that I was high as a kite as I sprinted a block each in three different directions to score the bottle before realizing there was no liquor store within sprinting distance. Son of a bitch! I had been gone at least 7 minutes, and I was beginning to panic. If I could but successfully score him this whiskey, there's no reason that it might not specifically fuel some innovative rewrites and rehearsal that night that could make the Pulitzer Committee realize they had better take things up a notch and award Buried Child a first-ever second Pulitzer. Inspired, I finally streaked into the Argentinian restaurant on the corner and found a bartender to take pity on me. He fetched me the bottle, which I gingerly cradled as I cautiously high-stepped it back to the theater. In hindsight, acquiring intoxicants for your playwright before rehearsal begins is probably not ever a good idea. That fact began to dawn on me that very night, shortly after I had deposited the Maker's Mark at Sam's seat in the audience, just before his significant other, Jessica Lang, arrived to join him. Her mood didn't seem great, and there was some quiet but stern talking happening, and it dawned on me that maybe the reason he surreptitiously sent the gopher kid out for booze was because he wasn't supposed to be having it. I honestly don't know if that was the case or how the evening played out between them, but I recall being painfully aware of the shift in tone the experience took. What had started out as a thrilling, personal, whiskey-flavored interaction starring me and America's greatest living playwright that left me breathless and blushing, I'm Sam Shepard's Kentucky Candyman, ended with the banal reality of a terrific-looking, middle-aged couple just doing their work and dealing with whatever individual circumstances they each brought to the table that night. My few years at Steppenwolf were invaluable for teaching me that, at the end of the day, every person puts their pants on just the same as me, even if these two people were packing some top-drawer buttocks into those britches. And it was just one in a lifelong string of reminders that the more I focused my attention on myself, the stupider I behaved. And the more I focused on others, the likelier I was to be of actual service, because I could then apprehend the work that needed doing. That was a good lesson, as I began to see the world a tiny bit more clearly. As it turns out, that was just the appetizer to a much meatier main course, because that 1995 play in Chicago was also the juncture in my life at which somebody first gave me some Wendell Berry stories. That somebody was Leo Burmester, a dearly departed, larger-than-life Kentucky actor who was also in the show, and could apparently smell the hay on me, or at least a waft of manure. And, recognizing a kindred spirit, he changed my life with his gesture. The spirit, running through Mr. Berry's writing, a farming and life philosophy I would come to know as agrarian, appealed to my core and curiosity in a way that has not yet abated. Agrarianism promotes an egalitarian agriculture based on morally sound land use. Now hang on, let me read that last sentence to you again. Agrarianism promotes an egalitarian agriculture based on morally sound land use. Have you ever heard a sentence even half that boring? As a person who makes his living creating popular culture of one sort or another, I can absolutely admit to the absence of pizzazz in this topic. This is terrible television, my inner mountebank barks as I notice that I am nonetheless unable to look away from it. The marrow of Wendell Berry's writing managed to reach something in my own bones, some deep truth that was not put there by me, but by my excellent mother and father, because I recognized that they were agrarian also. They had grown up on farms a few miles from each other, and the seeds of their quiet, steady lessons of thrift, service, and decency had been expertly planted in me and my siblings, but mine didn't truly begin to flower until my emergence from boyhood at age 25, when the sprouting seeds were watered with Mr. Berry's vision, and I've been completely screwed ever since, goddamn my eyes. I would never be that innocent MTV lover again. As if for the first time I could clearly see the folly in the shiny materialism I had so adored, and the folly in us humans as well, me first and foremost. the plenteous golden tresses cascading down Mr. Lee Roth's bright red leotard would never ensnare my fascination again. Ever since that epiphany, with my limited cognitive capacity, I have instead been able to periodically glimpse the ways in which we industriously sell to one another our own demise. One of the most pernicious ways in which we do that is by pretending and convincing one another that the planet's resources are unlimited and that we don't need to worry about the concerns of agrarians because they are old-fashioned and certainly not cool. Eventually, I befriended the Berry family and have endeavored to do my small part in supporting their work, that of stolidly sounding the alarm for some decades now, to draw our attention back to the land by which we are inescapably supported, and the neglected farm families who steward that land. This cause was lovingly detailed in a documentary by Laura Dunn I helped to produce, appropriately entitled Look and See. A few years ago, I had the substantial pleasure of introducing my parents to the Berry clan at the lunch table of Berry daughter Mary, who should frankly be elected to as high an agricultural post as we can vault her. You'll hear a bit more about her later, but for now it's important to know that the following ceremony occurred as we partook of her delectable brown sugar pie. The round oak table was peopled by Mary and her exemplary farmer husband, Steve Smith, Wendell, his winning bride, Tanya, and my mom and dad, or more importantly, four farmers and a retired nurse and a retired school teacher. They were kindly indulging the lunch's only trained juggler, me, as I described an idea for a new book about our population's general lack of any intimate knowledge of nature, a book that would hopefully add to the various disparate voices, reminding people that if you like to eat food, then you had best begin to give a shit about our farmers and our agriculture. Wendell had pushed his chair back from the table and crossed his legs, having finished his pie with fresh whipped cream. He leveled his gaze at me and said, "Look, examine the, quote, conservation of, quote, nature, not through the lens of John Muir, which is how everybody looks at it, but instead through the lens of Aldo Leopold." I swallowed audibly and nodded confidently, having no idea what the fudge he meant. That's great," I replied cluelessly, taken aback at this unexpected turn our dessert course had taken. "Sure, I suppose I mentioned the book in the hopes of winning some small approbation from him, but I never could have dreamed that I would finish that lunch having been tasked with a riddle-wrapped quest by my favorite wizard poet. Far be it from me to shirk my chores, so I set my investigation in motion. My journey took on a few different guises as I perambulated all over a whole bunch of nature, dovetailing Wendell's challenge into my perpetual search for the way to find nuance in every situation I can, even the ones that seem the most enraging and controversial. My tasks involved the making of mistakes, then discovering how to resolve those errors without being an asshole. A search that I now understand will never end. There were some pretty damn charming companions in my travels, including my bromance brothers Jeff Tweedy and George Saunders, with whom I hiked Glacier National Park, James Rebanks and his redoubtable family, who showed me how beautiful farming life can be in the hills of Cumbria, and of course my own bride, Megan Mullally, our dog Clover, and our Airstream, the Nutmeg, all of whom you'll meet shortly. Without them all, I could never have put together the following pages. I thank all of them very kindly. And I'll thank you, dear listener, for making it to at least the end of the introduction. Part 1. Chapter 1. Kalispell. Jesus is Lord. Okay. This was the message that greeted me, emblazoned across a large billboard as I pulled out of the Kalispell, Montana airport in July of 2019. I mean, wow. I had just flown in from Los Angeles for a week of hiking and camaraderie in nearby Glacier National Park, and my mood at that moment could not have been better. A few hours earlier, the relatively small flight had lifted me up and away from the cacophonous LA traffic and my hectic life, over the California Sierra Range, north over Nevada and Idaho. Ruggedly beautiful terrain, with very little civilization spoiling the majestic composition of mountains, lakes, clouds, and blue sky. I had sat looking out the window, breathing deeply to release the tension that for me seems to accompany the urban sprawl. Even as my spirit swelled with anticipation for this rare restorative break from the hustle of my life, and yes, from the bustle of it as well. I landed, collected my checked bag full of hiking gear, picked up my rental car, and headed out to meet up with my companions at the local REI, Recreational Equipment, Inc., to snag a couple of last-minute items. Pulling onto the main road, I was soon assaulted by a veritable barrage of billboards, reading, "Jesus is Lord. Choose life. Legalize Jesus. Fear God," etc. It was a rather ham-fisted display that didn't seem particularly well thought out. I mean, it didn't remotely give me a feeling of love or safety or welcome, which is what I would think a Christian-minded organization would desire. Even a dum-dum like me recalls Jesus' saying in Matthew 25, "I was hungry and you gave me food. I was thirsty and you gave me drink. I was a stranger and you welcomed me." But no, the clear message here in Kalispell was, fear God or else. If they're going to monopolize the local billboards, why wouldn't they try something less aggressive, like, "Welcome to our town. We hope you safely enjoy the ways in which we will be providing you succor in exchange for your tourism dollars. And by the way, we have a church or two, if you're looking for that sort of thing, but mainly, just don't forget to love one another." The whole notion came across as weird and clanky, because billboards are generally employed for advertising, for either goods and services or else political causes. However, "Jesus is Lord" would qualify more as an opinion, methinks, in answer to a question that I'm not aware anybody had asked, certainly not within the four doors of my sensible rental sedan. Dear listener, I have strong opinions as well that I'm happy to share, especially if you travel onto my turf. But I don't feel the need to erect a sign in my yard proclaiming, "Beef tallow is the fucking boss." Later in this volume, I will examine the apparent need for my fellow humans with certain mindsets to behave in this peculiar fashion. Not exactly the beginning I'd expected, I thought as I drove on, exhaling the rancor that these billboards had excited within me. I shouldn't have been surprised by them, I guess, since my trip had been pretty dreamy up until that point, and you have to figure things will get complicated sooner or later when one trucks into the realm of other people. We just don't all think the same, do we? I set out to write a book about us humans, particularly us Americans, and our relationship, or lack thereof, with the natural world, also known as our ecosystem. I knew that our country's complicated and loaded history vis-a-vis the various denominations of the Christian faith would play an important part in that conversation. I just hadn't expected it to slap me fulsomely across the kisser the moment I set foot in Montana. I drove on. As if to provide an immediate sweetening to the lousy taste these messages had left, once I had driven past the onslaught of the advertisements of the Lord, a whole new, much more positive visual offensive began, this time straight up turning me on to the current availability of huckleberries. The huckleberry is a sweet, wild berry, a little smaller than a blueberry. Every new advertising space now pitched me this apparently plentiful, sublime local berry in the form of pancakes, muffins, jams, jellies, and pie. Or, for the intrepid consumer, just full-on huckleberries by the handful. Visitors to the park may pick up to 1 quart of huckleberries per day. And this not just from the businesses of which you'd expect this sort of thing, your eateries and your lodgeries, but truly every business you saw. Len Grody Mufflers, you gotta try our baked huckleberry buckle. Now this was more like it. No matter how or where I chose to participate in religion or not, I could certainly wrap my head around the glory of huckleberry pie, and plenty of it in my near future. My smile returned. I'm a guy whom you might know from my work as an actor in film and television. Like, for example, is one particular guy with a healthy mustache who loved to eat bacon and giggle at a little horse, or another guy with a full ginger face bush who ate arugula by the handful and manifested quantum realities. Or maybe it was as the fellow with a Quaker beard and a propensity to drink too much beer and yell at handsome state troopers in burgundy pants. Some folks have also cottoned to my books, of which I have written 4 before this one. And then the best of you know me because I built some canoes and maintain a fine woodworking shop in Los Angeles. Although I try not to pick favorites when it comes to my readers. That day, the calendar read July of 2019, which means the country was a few years into the Trump presidency and therefore extremely confused. Because I am an artist who always maintains the attitude of a student, I wanted to get out into some remote nature, away from the various channels of distraction that ever increasingly rule my daily labors, and get to studenting. Letting the concerns of modern life slip away from my immediate attention, filling up my senses with Mother Nature's lush bounty, was foremost on my mind. Also, because I am a human being and subject to base passions, I wanted to go for a long walk in the woods so that I wouldn't punch anybody in the nose, and the same was true for my bromance partners Jeff and George. I met up with them at the local REI, where we exchanged hugs and giggled with excitement at being reunited, with nothing to do for the next week but wallow in some seriously magnificent national park vibes. While Jeff shopped for rain gear, I modeled mid-weight moisture-wicking tops for the group. There was a teal, half-zippered version from Patagonia that everyone agreed looked too cute on me to be denied, so I got to enjoy that special American rush of purchasing a fancy sweatshirt that I didn't know I needed when I walked in the door. More on that later when we get to consumerism. For now, let's meet these new players. George is George Saunders, the devilishly handsome American writer known for his masterful and wildly original fiction and his numerous contributions to rags like GQ and The New Yorker. Because I was such a serious fan of his writing, I had asked to meet George and interview him for my book Gumption in the spring of 2014. He generously agreed and we spent a day together in New York City, fertilizing what has become a powerful friendship. Jeff is Jeff Tweedy, the devilishly handsome singer-songwriter and frontman for the American rock band Wilco, and the author of two great books in his own right. I had been devoutly committed to the music of his first band, Uncle Tupelo, and then Wilco, for the better part of two decades before we met on the set of Parks and Recreation in January of 2014. He played Scott Tanner, a local rock star in the town of Pawnee, in an episode that I was directing, so I actually had the surreal-slash-daunting pleasure of getting to hire my hero. As with George, Jeff and I hit it off, and we found ourselves strongly enamored of each other. I had garnered the good fortune of two substantial new friendships, but everybody knows that the triangle is the strongest form in nature. And as a maker of furniture, I can certainly attest that it is the three-legged table or seat which exhibits the least wobble. It's also no secret that a grouping of three is the most effective number when it comes to establishing story structure and fomenting comedy. Just imagine the diminished value of the Two Stooges, or Goldilocks and the Four Bears, 17 Musketeers, 1 Blind Mice. Preposterous. Therefore, I suppose it naturally follows that Jeff and George were destined to also meet each other backstage at the final taping of the Colbert Report in December of 2014, completing the 2014 triangulation of our merry trio. Since then, we three have shared years of fellowship and chuckles and an extremely rich text thread. This trip was the first time we got to actually enjoy an outing all together, just the three of us, and I would be remiss if I didn't mention that it was Jeff's idea. I was playing a New Year's Eve show, opening for him at Largo in Los Angeles, and when I mentioned my new book idea to him, he immediately suggested that we three go take a walk somewhere beautiful together. I am the youngest of our crew, and when we're together, I often feel like my cool older brothers are letting me ride in the back of their Trans Am while they speak to me of topics like Kierkegaard and Foghat and empathy. So, with that in mind, you can bet your sweet bippy that I took Jeff's idea and ran all the way to the Montana tent store in which we now found ourselves. When I was but a mere lad in the 1970s and 80s, my family taught me to adventure on a budget, leaning heavily on park trail maps, fishing acumen, comic books, mosquito spray, and a masterful use of the charcoal grill and the ice chest, or as we called it, the cooler, to fill our days with as many hijinks and hot dogs as possible. And while there will be plenty of seat-of-our-pants capers in Part 3 of this book, I took the opposite approach on this trip and hired a company to plan our 6 days of arduous pleasure. It costs a bit more, certainly, but delegating most of the responsibility of such a journey to an outfitter is a highly recommended luxury if you can scrape up the dough. One great advantage of an adventure company was that I was able to get on the phone with a real human person who could compare and contrast for me in real time items like lodgings, assorted topographies, and activities. At the time, we weren't even sure which park we'd choose, but I knew we wanted to go the vintage National Park Lodge route if possible, and I also asked for a river rafting experience and a horseback ride. We could have additionally included a fishing excursion, but my travel mates were not as keen on fishing as the Offerman clan. The question did, however, engender an enjoyable riff in our three-way text thread about fishing from horseback, or then perhaps horsing from fishback, if that was a thing. I have since determined that it is indeed not a thing. My goal was to immerse myself in one of our most magnificent national parks, what many of us have come to regard as the pinnacle of nature's glory, far from the entangling web of my responsibilities in Los Angeles and the various channels of communication and distraction that populate those responsibilities. When I was a kid and my family would pile into our Suburban and drive from Illinois to Minnesota, or the Badlands, or even Yellowstone, we just let the relatives and neighbors know we'd be back in 2 weeks or so and to please water the tomatoes and keep an eye out for a postcard. Nowadays, I take the much more aggressive step of telling everyone in my close circle to simply leave me alone for 2 weeks. I relish nothing more than setting an automatic response to my texts and emails, which performs the exact same function as if I had hung a gone fishing sign in the window of my hardware store in days of yore. But that day, in REI, our focus was gear. Jeff had decided on a sensible poncho for the rain, and we were now just lounging about in menswear like a bunch of Caesars at the bathhouse, openly objectifying me in my adorable new fleece, speculating about the revelations awaiting us in the coming days. Looking at the three of us, I couldn't help but marvel at how much things had changed during our lifetimes. Growing up, all three of us belonged to households where your choices in outdoor gear would be limited to coat, with or without hat or gloves. Now, we were in a spacious specialty store that sold a vast variety of gear for every conceivable outdoor activity in an array of colorful choices. You can tell a lot about a person by the way he, she, or they spend money, and just such an interesting delineation was about to befall the three of us. Each of us grew up in an extremely working-class environment, clumsily learning the ropes of life alongside everybody else while setting our respective courses for what would become our disparate artistic journeys. I dare say one of the reasons the three of us get along so well is that we have Chicago in common. We all have lived and loved there, sometimes even together. And we've all vomited within two blocks of the Art Institute. We often feel like loving brothers, and we say so in person and in our text thread, with messages like, "I love you, brothers." But like any set of siblings, we also have our idiosyncratic differences. Since I had never been out in the woods with either of these guys, only warmly embraced in the luxurious arms of civilization, what with her comfortably controllable climate and her readily available preponderance of food and beverages, I had no expectations going in regarding the respective degrees to which we would outfit ourselves with gear. Jeff and I definitely came down on the side of, quote, into gear, or even, quote, psyched about our gear, which, methinks, is both a modern delight and a dilemma. That morning, when we gathered in the homey lobby of our lodge, we quickly fell into a deep chat about Jeff's new boots and blister-proof socks, and my engineered hiking raincoat and my Camelback water reservoir system. It would have been clear to anyone eavesdropping on us that we had enjoyed that amazing, particularly modern form of consumerism by which one uses the internet to ask, "What is the recommended version of any item I might purchase?" Then, after reading reviews and five-in-the-know tips from experts, decides upon a selection. We happily partook of this luxury, utilizing some disposable income, exploiting, at least momentarily, our comfortable seats on the bus of the leisure class. George's gear, on the other hand, sported the obvious signs of mere normalcy. He was outfitted with a backpack, a hoodie, and a quilted flannel shirt that had clearly not been purchased new for the trip, and bore the labels of brands that didn't even have their own app. His beat-up brown leather hiking boots also advertised years of previous enjoyment, but it was his water bottle that made me realize how his whole gear vibe was screaming unassuming pragmatism. It was one of those cheap, janky aluminum bottles that you get at a convention or on the first day of work when you get a tote bag and a crappy water bottle that reads Newsmax or some such. All of this suddenly added up, and I realized George is a badass. Professionally, he writes and speaks very eloquently about how one's fiction requires mainly rewriting and editing and rewriting and editing and so on. And I think that he has been able to apply this discipline so effectively to his own life that he is able to simply engage only in what is necessary. He had boots. He had warm layers. He had water. Boom. Let's hike. Those 3 hours Nick and Jeff spent shopping? Fun, maybe, but not necessary. He lives right. I think that a downside of the kind of shopping Jeff and I enjoyed is that perhaps it can fool a person into creating an actual deficit in life. I can't go have fun doing X activity because I don't have the proper gear. Of course, one should absolutely invest in safety and responsibly attack any activity with common sense and curiosity. But if you've been around the block like George, then you might realize that you can hike a national park trail without dropping a few bills on a fancy new pair of boots. I've never, to my knowledge, finished the ups and downs of an arduous day-long hike, arriving back at camp only to lament, "Man, that was so fun, but think how much better it could have been if only my middle underlayer was self-wicking. Damn!" To each their own, I say, because I can certainly understand both sides of the issue, based on my own hard-earned experience. When I was 11 years old, heading into my 6th grade basketball season, the Manuka Junior High School Athletic Department handed us boys a ditto-copied form to take home and have our folks sign. The form was a purchase order for Converse high tops, and on it we would fill in our shoe size and whether we would prefer the canvas or the leather version of said shoes. I think the canvas were about $16 and the leather were closer to $40. Naturally, I had a screaming fit with my parents over why I needed the leather shoes, but of course their frugality won the day and I got the canvas. I had a fine, not remarkable season, racking up an impressive tally of rebounds, which was apparently my specialty. And I am dead certain that my play would not have been improved one tiny whit if I had executed it in more expensive sneakers. But goddammit, I would have looked so much cooler. When it comes to footwear, I have since spent a lifetime choosing it for its functionality rather than its fashion. All things considered, I'm grateful, because my parents were right on that count, and it was from lessons like that one that I learned to become the practical person that I am. Then again, if they had relented and bought me the doper shoes, it would have saved us all from having to listen to a sobbing 11-year-old boy. If that option had occurred, it would most certainly not have been even remotely the first time that an expenditure of honest, hard-earned cash had been gladly forked over by parents to prevent a bout of caterwauling. So I suppose you could aver that either side was right. Nuance. That day in the REI, our concern was less with the nuance of the moment than it was with matching the right gear to our impending medium-intensity adventures. We wanted to be comfortably and safely attired so that our attention could be free to muse and percolate on the ways in which we humans relate to nature, as it were. Jeff mentioned a couple of day hikes on the Appalachian Trail and the deep solace he had felt there. This made him wonder aloud, Do we feel such an overwhelming peace when we enter the woods because the chaos of nature is a balm to the rectilinear order of mankind? George countered, or is civilization the chaos and nature's inscrutable design the respite because of its older-than-the-hills systems and patterns? I shook my head and smiled at the random, exquisite moment we were sharing there in an REI store. I nodded and took mental notes, as I so often do when these two lovely thinkers set to musing. In his book, A Swim in a Pond in the Rain, George said, through the lens of a Turgenev story, "Emotional power is the highest aim of art, and can be attained even in the face of clumsy craft." And I was moved. I felt seen. Once I read that, I immediately pronounced it to be the motto of our gang, because I aspire to the degree to which Jeff and George are able to consistently achieve emotional power in their work, despite their sometimes clumsy attempts. They are among the teachers from whom I have learned that when you make art with confidence, then clumsiness doesn't play as clumsiness, but panache. I imagined myself grabbing the mouthpiece to the store's PA system, hopping up on a fake boulder, and confidently busting out with, "And so I go to the woods. As I go in under the trees, dependably, almost at once, and by nothing I do, things fall into place. I enter an order that does not exist outside in the human spaces. I feel my life take its place among the lives, the trees, the annual plants, the animals and birds, the living of all these and the dead that go and have gone to make the life of the earth. I am less important than I thought. The human race is less important than I thought. I rejoice in that. My mind loses its urgings, senses its nature, and is free." Wendell Berry, A Native Hill, 1969. Dozens of people would have gathered around me, I dreamt, in awe, adoring me with wet eyes. And when I finished speaking, they would have covered their mouths with their hands, almost in disbelief, then warmly applauded, looking at each other, nodding, quietly mouthing the words, "He did it." I wish I had done it. It would have been so cool, and the perfect send-off to chapter one of my book. I always wished that I had a bunch of such literary gold packed away in my melon to be brandished casually, astonishing all within earshot. This is how I often feel when spending time with George and Jeff. Their particular talents are for generating wildly original content of their own in the form of ideas, words, and music. Whereas my skill set has more to do with artfully manipulating my eyebrows and leveling an oak tabletop. When art speaks directly to a deep part of my being, as theirs often does, I think some version of, "Oh man, this is so good. This is how I will write my fiction or cut my rock and roll record," forgetting momentarily that those are not my fields of study. But that day, in the actual REI, I merely mumbled something in agreement and said we should get out of the shopping center and check into our lodge so we could get an early jump on the other birds in the morning, worm-wise. I had a momentous feeling that if we could leave the plastic and asphalt trappings of the human-made world behind, the coming days would present us with the opportunity to take on board some real religion. Chapter 2. Logan Pass, Hidden Lake. A man on foot, on horseback, or on a bicycle will see more, feel more, enjoy more in 1 mile than the motorized tourists can in 100 miles. Edward Abbey, Desert Solitaire. Our guide for the week was a well-read fellow in his early 30s named John, who absolutely looked the part of Western States Trail Skipper. Thin beard, connoting youth, barrelish beefy frame draped in outfitter-style garments topped off with a cowboy hat. As he drove us into Glacier National Park, he regaled us with information about the history of the enormous space, which was established by President Taft in 1910, converting what had previously been the Lewis and Clark Forest Reserve. The breathtaking topography of its 1,583 square miles was available for us to skip about in thanks to an uneasy agreement between the U.S. government and the Blackfeet tribe, a subject which will require more scrutiny in later pages. How had we ended up in Glacier National Park? Excellent question. Back when I was planning the trip, I'd called the outfitter John worked for to get some guidance on where three pilgrims might find some gorgeous hiking. The answer, according to the experts I consulted, was Glacier, which seemed to have just what the doctor, me, ordered, in terms of pristine wilderness in close proximity to relatively comfy hotel beds. I wasn't sure exactly where to start, but I felt that this was as good a place as any to begin my search to solve the conundrum of Wendell's advice. He had told me to frame our perception of wilderness less through the lens of John Muir and more through that of Aldo Leopold. So here I was, about to jump with both feet into a substantial example of John Muir's, quote, pristine wilderness. That titillating phrase, in association with his name, brought to mind classic iconic park scenes of the American West, like El Capitan in Yosemite and the Grand Canyon. We were going to spend a week marinating in the splendor of such verdant outdoor settings, historically unsullied by human presence, except, of course, for a trail here and there. But hang on. Was Glacier, or any national or even state or local park, actually the pristine wilderness I'd been imagining? Or did we only consider it to be virginal for an all-too-common American reason? Because we said so. I came into this trip as a casually comfortable consuming citizen, also known as ignorant, simply into the park, mainly for all the beautiful reasons I could see on the cool posters that the national parks print. It was an amazing place to go hiking with my two friends. But once I began unpacking the history of this majestic real estate, I was in for a surprise. And the fact that I could still be surprised by such a revelation speaks to my ignorance. In our very first SUV ride on the very first day, our guide, John, who had extensively studied the local history both geographically and sociologically, began to illuminate the situation with the Blackfeet. As he explained, this enormous area was far from unsettled before it became the Lewis and Clark Forest Reserve in 1897, and subsequently Glacier National Park in 1910. The Blackfeet, a tribe, which actually consisted of four or more smaller tribal nations, had been living all over the park area for thousands of years. As the early opportunists of the burgeoning United States began to invade the territory, the Blackfeet were expelled from their own land and eventually forbidden to hunt there as well, a situation that has lasted until even today. I was taken aback to hear this, but why should this have come as any surprise to me? When I thought about it, I realized that we modern Americans would be hard-pressed to come up with a single scenario in which we treated the indigenous peoples with anything remotely resembling fairness. It's laughably shameful. I mean, think about it. Have you ever read a historical account of the settlement of North America, in which the English, Spanish, French, etc., dealt with the native tribes inhabiting a certain area in any way that was remotely cool? Then, as now, greed ruled the day. Besides the outright pillaging, genocide, and brutal warfare, even when the white folks managed to pull off a negotiation that was halfway peaceable, it was still flagrant robbery in broad daylight. These tribes saw the lands they called home invaded six ways to Sunday by foreign hordes. Those natives would have been perfectly justified, according to the Stand Your Ground laws that we now have in more than 30 of our United States, in killing each and every prospector and trapper and surveyor who came off the boat and over the hill. Don't get me wrong, they certainly tried their damnedest to fend off the whites, but the tribes were simply far outstripped by our capability and capacity for violence. My specific astonishment in Glacier came from hearing the Europeans' rapacity described simply. Their first response upon seeing the land was the old standard, "What here can we sell?" I mean, sure, there was probably a momentary revelation of, "Whoa, this place is dope as hell. Look at that lake." But that can't have lasted very long. I mean, we're talking about the first American capitalists here. So once the appreciative pastoral murmurings died down, then likely followed, "Okay, how can we sell it?" The answer involved voracious hunting and trapping. Suddenly a, "Hang on, guys!" echoed through the pines as the new breed of Americans paused to attend that timeless and inevitable maneuver. "Is there gold?" They immediately applied themselves to finding out, bringing with them the ruination that accompanies any rush for precious metals in the form of boom towns and the desecration of the landscapes and waterways. Soon enough, it was, "Oh shit, hold up y'all, there's no gold." But no matter. Despite a thin, sporadic stream of income for our settlers thus far, the previous inhabitants had nonetheless been beaten off their land, bullied and cajoled into treaties that our government then failed to honor, and finally saw their survivors placed into the reservation shuffle on lesser terrain to the east of what became the park. Maybe there's something to be learned by looking at the way this history was written, and by whom. I'll say one thing for sure, it wasn't written by the Blackfeet. Once the tribes were safely relegated to their reservations and it became clear that there was no gold or silver to be mined, the park was free to become what it became, a park. Enter the likes of John Muir and George Bird Grinnell, who is generally credited with founding Glacier. There is also Gifford Pinchot, John Muir's frenemy, who was conservation-minded in general, but with more nuance than that simple term connoted. Brandishing the mercurial trait known as human nature, he also insisted that forest lands specifically should be put to commercial use. There was and will be more contemplation on such issues to come, but at that moment, the focus was setting off on our first hike. Despite our early morning, the parking lot at the Logan Pass Hidden Lake Visitor Center was completely full. John dropped us off to get a head start while he slowly circled, waiting for a spot to open up, making his morning just as fun as a trip to the grocery store the day before Thanksgiving. We cruised through the gift shop, enjoying the people watching more than the going to the sun road signs and the Pendleton blankets on offer, although I will say that I always find the items for sale in a national park souvenir shop to be more substantial and honest, and therefore desirable, than the crap in similar retail spots in more commercial locations. I saw that John was still making slow, maddening loops through the parking lot, so I set off with Jeff and George on the trail to Hidden Lake Overlook, knowing John would catch up to us since the trail was of the out-and-back variety. Of the 700-odd miles of trails in the park, this was the most popular, the most likely to be traversed by tourists of every stripe, commencing as it did from the main gift shop. It was a moderate, mostly uphill walk over a broad, very nicely maintained trail, with a lot of wide boardwalks and terraced steps designed for an easier, more accessible strolling experience. The original plan had been to hike down to the actual lake, but that option was temporarily closed to the public due to some grizzly bears indulging in a fish-feeding frenzy on the lakeshore. Dangerous to begin with, the bears were apparently to be treated with even more cautious distance when engaged in a trout-eating contest. We found ourselves amongst a scattered gaggle of way too many fellow hikers, half of them family groups who seemed more suited to a day at Disneyland, exhibiting little to no reverence for their surroundings, not to mention for their fellow walkers, who were definitely there to revere some shit. Some of them chatted loudly as they ambled or shouted at their children to stay on the trail or slow down or speed up or don't you eat that. They called to mind all of the ill-mannered people I've encountered hither and yon who absolutely give Americans a reputation for being loud, rude, and stupid. The woman at Stonehenge yelling to her man, "Oh my God, they look totally real." Or the updog guys. Oh, shit. I had to share this doozy with Jeff and George. This is a favorite story at our house of a remarkable experience some years ago that befell me and my bride, the fabulous Megan Mullally. Back in 2002, Megan and I were in line with our parents one Christmas Eve, checking into a fancy Santa Fe restaurant for dinner. The wait was growing tedious, because the group of three frat guys in front of us, red-faced, wearing way too little clothing for the freezing weather, were loudly horsing around with some bit. "Man, it totally smells like updog in here," said one of the guys, Brody, I imagine. "Oh, rad, Brody, it does." "Sick, smells just like updog," answered Rafe, presumably. "Whoa, definitely updog," added Trip, unquestionably. This was quickly getting old, when the maitre d' finally bit. "What's updog?" he innocently asked, words which he had barely gotten out before the jabroni three erupted into jubilant shouts of, "What's up, dog? Yeah, what's up, dog? What's up, dog?" slapping each other high fives. The crazy part of that instance was that, as annoyingly as the whole episode came off, we actually really enjoyed the joke, as did everyone around us. These surfer-voiced party bros, at whom we had all been rolling our eyes moments beforehand, now had us all smiling and nodding at one another begrudgingly. Americans. Nuance. The loudmouths at Hidden Lake were not quite so cute, I'm sorry to report, but just like on so many bad days on the internet, there were adorable animals coming to our rescue. The stars of the walk were a number of very cute silver-bellied marmots, furry mid-size mammals with the personality, perhaps, of a curious beaver. Of these marmots, a 30-something dad up ahead on the trail kept erroneously but enthusiastically yelling to his group, "A badger! You guys, check it out! A badger!" He was so loud. The epitome of an audience member oblivious to the grief he was causing his fellow participants. We three brothers looked at one another, narrowed our eyes, and increased our pace to escape the dumbass. It was an easy walk that morning. It occurred to me that our guide, John, was testing us with this opening maneuver. From our reactions to the day's scenery and level of difficulty, he would have a much better chance of correctly discerning our degree of relative comfort in the rugged environs of the park, thereby suiting the rest of the week's activities to better fit our needs and preferences. This was also a brilliant bit of psychological strategy from a professional outdoorsman who preferred to rise early and beat the crowd in every possible circumstance, but might find his propensity for promptness hampered by the soft morning habits of the city folk in his tender. By turning us loose on the Glacier Park Trail, populated the most like a shopping mall, he could then say going forward, "Oh, you didn't like the guy hollering badger? Well, then we'll need to get up and hit the trail by 6:30 a.m. to avoid those folks." He needn't have worried in our case. Many of the pedestrians we dealt with on that morning were utilizing a gait that, in fact, reminded me of well-fed mall walkers, grazing along with no particular need to achieve an objective beyond gazing upon the displays of retail capitalism. I have been given to understand that the average visit to a national park is only half of one day, which I guess is not that different from a day hanging out at the mall. Except that this bullshit park lacks a proper food court and a baby gap. This half-day statistic gets at the heart of what I think is wrong with the way we look at nature, because we treat it like an attraction at a theme park. Hidden Lake? Can we see it from the car? No? How far do we have to walk? Not too far? Okay, cool. I feel like national and state parks of all sizes, as well as national seashores, preserves, and forests, can come across to our simple brains like any random sight, as in, we should take in the sights. Have you seen the observatory? It's so dope. And there's an Egon Schiele exhibit at LACMA. Oh my god, and you have to see Joshua Tree. It's so cool, these rocks. Now, although my tone may sound a bit derisive, I am reasonably sure I have uttered these words, and others like them. I'm not sure we know, sometimes, the difference between going to the woods and going to M&M's World in Times Square, and perhaps we could re-examine the ways in which we apprehend the outdoors. If nothing else, we could start with understanding the difference between works of nature and works of humankind. I was once hiking solo in Arizona, lost in a red rock reverie as I trudged along, intoxicated by the smell of the sage. My quietude was pretty quickly ruined, however, as a large pink jeep full of 8 tourists came roaring up a very rough road across the washed-out river gully I was skirting. My first question would be, what in the hell is the enjoyable part of being jostled by boulders and potholes until the fillings have all fled your teeth? It's kind of like the difference between seeing the miniature Eiffel Tower in Vegas versus the actual structure in Paris, which is a city in France. I've argued with folks in my hometown when they are singing the praises of Las Vegas in general, and specifically getting to see things like a facsimile of said tower, or the mini version of New York City that is the New York, New York casino, complete with a 1/3 scale Statue of Liberty. I have piped up and said, "Well, you should check out the real thing in either of those cases." And they have looked at me like I was an abject idiot, like I was the one missing the whole point. And I suppose I was. For them, I think the attraction is that someone has gone to the trouble of reducing these larger, messier, real destinations, and then lined their simplified avatars up conveniently in a row on the Vegas Strip, where they can be briefly and efficiently ogled from the comfort of a 3-5 Busch Light buzz. They will gladly pay to not go to New York or Paris, and instead enjoy the several sinful delights available in the radius of a few Vegas city blocks,